of the day. Cooler here, 17 degrees for Stornoway, 19 in Belfast, 20 in Glasgow. And then for the rest of the week, as I mentioned, northern and western areas seeing cloud and some patchy rain, staying largely dry across the southeast and turning a little warmer as well. That's all for now. It's back to you, Jim.
Thank you, Ben. Well, our new book of the week is a true crime classic, which is regarded in Latin America as the first of the genre. On a summer evening in 1956, a dozen men were arrested in an apartment in Buenos Aires on suspicion of involvement in a rebellion against the government. Almost all were innocent.
News of the secret June 1956 executions in Buenos Aires first came to me by chance towards the end of that year in a La Plata cafe where people played chess. 6 months earlier in that same place, we'd been startled around midnight by the shooting nearby that launched the assault on the police department, General Vargas' failed uprising. I remember how we left the café en masse to see what the celebration was all about, and I remember how the closer we got to San Martín Square, the more serious we became, as our group became smaller, and how when I reached the bus station, there was a poor boy in a guard's uniform saying that revolution or not, no one was going to take away his gun. I remember finding myself alone in 54th Street, just 3 blocks away from my house, and when I finally got past the line of fire, discovering soldiers on the roof of my house, and in the kitchen, and the bedrooms, but mainly in the bathroom. Since then I've developed an aversion to houses that face police departments or barracks. I also haven't forgotten how, standing by the window blinds, I heard a recruit dying in the street, who didn't say long live the nation, but instead, don't leave me here alone, you sons of bitches. After that, I don't want to remember anything else, not the announcer's voice at dawn, reporting that 18 civilians had been executed, nor the wave of blood that flooded the country, until General Vargas' execution 3 days later. I'm not interested in Vargas. I'm not interested in Perón. I'm not interested in revolution. Can I go back to playing chess? Back to the detective stories I write. To the other things I do to earn a living, and that I call journalism, even though that's not what it is. Violence has spattered my walls. There are bullet holes in the windows. I've seen a car full of holes with a man inside it. But it's only chance that's put all this before my eyes. It could have happened 100 miles away. It could have happened when I wasn't there. 6 months later, on a suffocating summer night, with a glass of beer in front of him, a man says to me, "One of the executed men is alive." I don't know what it is about, this vague, highly unlikely story that manages to draw me in. I don't know why I asked to talk to that man, Juan Carlos Liveraga. But afterwards I do know why. I look at that face, the hole in his cheek, the bigger hole in his throat, his dull eyes, where a shadow of death still lingers. I feel insulted, just as I felt when I heard that chilling cry while standing behind the blinds. Liveraga tells me his unbelievable story. I believe it on the spot. And right there, the investigation, this book, is born. The long night of June the 9th comes back to me. I won't think about anything else for almost a year. I'll leave my house and my job behind. I'll go by the name Francisco Freire. I have a fake ID. A friend will lend me his house. I'll carry a gun. And at every moment, the characters of the story will come back to me obsessively. Because what Liveraga knows is that there was a bunch of about 10 of them, that they were taken out to be shot, and that he and Yunta are still alive. That's the story I hear him repeat before the judge one morning, and I can see the judge doubting it, right up until Liveraga's voice climbs over that gruelling hill to where all that's left is a sob, as he pulls aside his clothes so that everyone can see the other gunshot wound. Then we all feel ashamed. That's the story I write feverishly and in one sitting, so that no one beats me to it, but that later gets more wrinkled every day in my pocket because I walk around all of Buenos Aires and hardly anyone wants to know about it, let alone publish it. It's funny, really, to read through all the newspapers 12 years later and see that this story didn't exist. Then finally, I find a man who's willing to take the risk. He's trembling and sweating because he's no movie hero either, but the story's printed, a flurry of little yellow leaflets in the kiosks, badly designed, with no signature, but it's printed, and it's snatched up by 10,000 anonymous hands. There's a young journalist named Enriqueta Muniz, who's been with me from the very beginning, and has put herself entirely on the line. It's difficult to do her justice in a few sentences. I simply want to say that whenever I say, I did, I went, I discovered, it should be heard as we. And there were several important things that she got alone. One afternoon we take the train to José León Suárez. We have a little map that Livaraga has drawn for us in pencil. At dusk, we walk about 8 blocks along a paved road, catch sight of the tall, dark row of eucalyptus trees that the executioner, Rodriguez Moreno, had deemed an appropriate place for the task. And Enriqueta says, it happened here, and casually sits down on the ground so that I can take a picnic photo of her, because just at that moment a tall, sullen man with a big, sullen dog walks by. Livaraga's story feels more real now. Here was the path. Over there was the ditch, the garbage dump, and the night all around us. The following day we go to see the other survivor, Miguel Angel Iunta, who greets us by slamming the door in our faces. I don't know what it is that we say to him through the screen door that gets him to gradually come out and talk. It kills you to listen to Iunta, because you get the feeling you're watching a movie that's been rolling and rolling in his head since the night it was filmed. All the tiny details are there, the faces, the lights, the small noises, the escape from among tin cans, the smell of gunpowder and panic. You get the feeling that once he finishes, he's going to start again from the beginning, just as the endless loop must start over again in his head. This is how they executed me. But the more upsetting thing is the affront to his person that this man carries within him, how he's been hurt by the mistake they made with him. Because after all, he's a decent man who wasn't even a Peronist. You can ask anybody, they'll tell you. It seems the story could end here because there's no more to tell. 2 survivors and the rest are dead. I could publish the interview with Junta and go back to that abandoned chess game. But it's not over. At the last minute, Junta mentions that there might be a 3rd man who survived, and we go in search of Horacio Di Chiano. It seems as though people know us already. A young girl stops us in the street. The man you're looking for is in his house. They'll tell you he isn't, but he is. And once more we offer wheedling words until the rustiest lock turns and Mr. Horacio Di Chiano appears, holding on to his wife, who leads him by the hand like a child. So, there are 3. And then the newspaper receives an anonymous letter saying that an ex-NCO called Gavino managed to escape too. So, there are 4. The letter says Gavino made his way to the Bolivian embassy and was granted asylum. I don't find him there, but his friend, Torres, smiles and, counting on his fingers, says, "You're missing too." He tells me about Troxler and Benavides. So there are 6, possibly 7, though Torres can't remember the name of the sergeant. 2 or 3 days later, I go back to see him again and offer a name. Rogelio Diaz? His face lights up. Now I've spoken to survivors, widows, orphans, conspirators, political refugees, and I've written half of this book, and am once more roaming around in search of someone who'll publish it. The Yacoveya brothers have started a magazine, and I talk to Bruno, Then Tullio reads the manuscript and laughs. Not at the manuscript, but at the mess he's about to get himself into. And he goes for it. This story was first published in the Majoria from May to July of 1957. Later there were appendices, corollaries and denials, but this is how it started. On the night of June the 9th, Nicholas Carranza wasn't a happy man. We'll never really know what was gnawing at him. A man carries so many thoughts with him to the grave. When he got home, his wife lifted her gaze from the sewing machine and smiled with a mix of sadness and joy. It was always the same. Her man came in like this, on the run, in the night. Sometimes he stayed the night and then disappeared for weeks. Sometimes he'd have messages sent to her at so-and-so's house, and she'd be the one going for a meeting, leaving their six children with a neighbour. Her husband was a Peronist and a fugitive. He'd once been arrested for distributing leaflets. Over supper, she tried to get him to hand himself in. Maybe they won't beat you. At least you can get out of jail. Her husband got up and reached for his overcoat. I've stolen nothing. I've killed no one. I'm not a criminal. She looked at him, her face resigned. Where are you going? I have some things to take care of. I might be back tomorrow. He went into the bedroom and kissed his children one by one. Then he walked the short distance to Francisco Garibotti's house. Garibotti is 38 years old and has 16 years' service with the Belgrano Railway under his belt. Nowadays he works the local line. He's nearly finished his dinner when the doorbell rings. What did Nicholas Carranza come for? His wife later recalled resentfully. He came to take him away. And they brought him back to me a corpse. The two men talk for a while, then her husband tells her, I have to head out, just to run an errand. Anticipating her reproach, he adds, I'll explain later. Truth is, I'm a little tired of this guy and all his ideas. This is the last time I've given the time of day. The two friends take a local train to the Barrio of Florida. No one can testify as to what they talked about. Maybe Carranza knew about the uprising in the making and mentioned it to Garibotti. Maybe he simply said, let's go to our friends to listen to the radio. There's going to be some news. Maybe they just went to play cards or listen to the boxing match that was going to be on the radio. All we know is that Garibotti left without really feeling like it and intended to come back soon. He was unarmed. Later that night, he'll let himself be arrested without any sign of resistance. He'll let himself be killed, like a child, without one rebellious movement. At Florida, the two men get off the train and walk six blocks. They cross Franklin Street, and Carranza stops in front of a country house with two small light blue wooden gates that lead directly into a garden. They go in through the right gate and walk up a narrow alleyway bordered by a privet hedge. Then they ring the bell. The house that Carranza and Garibotti have walked into, where the first act of the drama will unfold, has two apartments, one in the front and one at the back. The back apartment is rented out to a man called Torres. The owner of the building, Mr. Horacio Di Chiano, lives in the front with his family. He's a small man with a moustache and glasses, about 50 years old. For the last 17 years, he's been employed as an electrician. His ambition is to retire.
Nigel Anthony has been reading Operation Massacre by Rodolfo Walsh. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions. BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015, today Tuesday the 20th of August. There are warnings of gales in Shannon, Rockall, Bailey and southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Atlantic low, 1002, moving steadily northeast, expected just west of Rockall, 1004, by 1800 Tuesday. High, northeast Fitzroy, 1028, expected Portland with little change by the same time. The area forecast for the next 24 hours, Viking, north at zero. Southwesterly 5 or 6, occasionally 7 in North Viking, but mainly 4 or 5 in South. Showers, good. South at 0, westerly 4, showers, then fair, good. 40s,